Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
You're with Radio National Summer, and welcome now to Hindsight. Today we set sail with the first great Antarctic explorer, Captain James Cook. It's not well known that the first major scientific expedition to the Antarctic was led by Cook 230 years ago. It's even less well known that that voyage was recorded by a young German writer and natural historian who sailed with Cook, Georg Forster. Georg Forster's A Voyage Round the World was one of the most famous and influential travel narratives of its time, a scientific adventure story which ranges from the terrors of the Antarctic ice to cannibalism amongst the Maori in New Zealand. Today you'll hear readings from Forster's book, Cook's journals, and a novel based on Forster's life. Tom Morton takes us into the ice world.
A Voyage Round the World, in His Britannic Majesty's Sloop Resolution, commanded by Captain James Cook, by George Forster, Fellow of the Royal Society. London, 1777. On the long, dreary days amidst the ice, no one goes on deck who has no business there, for the wind flays anything that moves. In the great cabin, Cook huddles over his charts, murmuring contentedly to himself.
Friday, 24th of December, 1773. Thermometer, noon, 32 degrees. Our ropes were like wires, sails like board or plates of metal, the cold so intense as hardly to be endured. The whole sea in a manner covered with ice, a hard gale and a thick fog.
The charts live inside him. He reads them as other men read the Bible. More than any other man alive, he knows how to translate the language of the charts into the speech of reef and rock and current. But now we are sailing beyond the reach of any chart that man has drawn before.
As Captain Cook huddled over his charts, a young man was gazing out from the windows of the great cabin on the Resolution. He was Georg Forster, then barely 20 years old, and already a seasoned traveller and adventurer. As a boy of 10, Georg had made a journey with his father deep into Russia and down the Volga River. That journey had opened his eyes to the wide spaces of the world, and now he turned his gaze on a landscape that no one had ever seen before.
Sometimes we tacked our way painstakingly between immense fields of flat ice, white deserts on which flocks of blue petrels in their several hundreds would settle and then rise in a dense, screeching cloud into a white sky. Then we would find our way out again into clear water and breathe easier until the fog fell and lifted to show a great ice island bearing down on us. Some white whales of a huge size, seemingly 60 feet long, were observed here, and many penguins floated past us, standing upright on small bits of ice.
The clouds near the horizon were of a perfect snow whiteness and were difficult to be distinguished from the ice hills whose lofty summits reached the clouds.
We now entertained hopes of penetrating to the south as far as other navigators have done towards the North Pole. But on the 30th, about 7 o'clock in the morning, we discovered a solid ice field of immense extent before us, which bore from east to west.
I will not say it was impossible anywhere to get in among this ice, but I will assert that the bare attempting of it would be a very dangerous enterprise and what I believe no man in my situation would have thought of. I, whose ambition leads me not only farther than any other man has been before, but as far as I think it possible for man to go, was not sorry at meeting with this interruption, as it in some measure relieved us from the dangers and hardships inseparable with the navigation of the southern polar regions.
I, whose ambition leads me farther than any man has been before me. So wrote Captain James Cook in his journal on Sunday the 30th of January 1774. In many ways, that moment was the pinnacle of Cook's career as an explorer. He'd guided his ship through savage storms, treacherous ice fields, and thick fog deep into the Antarctic Circle. Georg Forster was a witness to that moment. When he finally returned to London after 3.5 years at sea, Georg Forster wrote an account of his travels with Cook, which was called A Voyage Round the World. It's one of the first great pieces of modern travel writing, and it made young Georg famous. The salons of Europe opened their doors to him. He got to know Benjamin Franklin, Goethe, Tom Paine, and Mary Wollstonecraft. But Forster and his work have been largely forgotten for the last 200 years. It's only recently that A Voyage Round the World has been republished, thanks in part to the efforts of an Australian anthropologist, Nicholas Thomas.
I'd grown up with an idea of Cook and Cook's voyages, which, frankly, in a sense, was a bit dull. One had this sense of rather one-dimensional navigational exercises of maritime heroism. George Forster's voyage narrative, which had been published at about the same time in 1777, just after the voyage, was a fabulously rich account of the experience of travel of every aspect, really, ranging from the horrific conditions that they dealt with, particularly in the Antarctic, issues of conflict on board, issues of debate about sexual contacts, about violence in relation to indigenous people. There's an extraordinary intelligence in those books, and they're also striking for their lack of censorship.
Nicholas Thomas, he's director of the Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology at Cambridge, and he co-edited the new edition of Forster's Voyage Round the World. Now, you might be wondering, what was Georg Forster doing on the Resolution in the first place?
Often I think about how much chance and not effort or design on my part has shaped the course of my life. If the famous Mr. Banks, the toast of all London, foremost scientist of his time, hero of the endeavour, if the incomparable Mr. Banks had not had a tiff with Captain Cook over the size of his cabin, I should have amounted to nothing.
Originally, Sir Joseph Banks was supposed to be the chief scientist on the voyage, as he had been on Cook's first voyage. But Banks demanded that he travel with a large retinue of secretaries, servants, and 2 horn players for entertainment. There were even rumours that Banks was going to bring along his mistress, disguised as a man. A huge cabin was built to house Banks's retinue, but the cabin was so big that it made the ship top-heavy. The ship's master declared that she'd capsize as soon as she hoisted full sail. So the cabin was torn down again, whereupon Banks spat the dummy in disgust and withdrew from the voyage. A replacement had to be found in a hurry, and that replacement was a German naturalist living in London, Johann Reinhold Forster, and his son Georg.
Well, Johann Reinhold Forster was really one of those extraordinary intellectuals who you only get during the 18th century. He was interested in everything from mineralogy to antiquities to Oriental languages. He was particularly interested in natural history and botany and zoology and so forth, but he also had very strong interests in human society that were enormously stimulated by the Pacific Island passages of the second voyage.
Johann Reinhold Forster was feckless, overbearing, and very bright. You could say he was a kind of intellectual social climber. He'd taken his wife and children from their home in what was then East Prussia to England, where he'd managed to get himself elected to the Royal Society. When Johann Reinhold got the gig as chief scientist on the Resolution, he insisted that his son Georg go with him. Georg was a rather awkward, precocious youth with a gift for languages and a strongly independent mind.
He's a very attractive sort of character. He's a young, liberal-minded, a bit of a revolutionary, and throws himself into the experiences which are sort of seen through a scientific framework, because, of course, he was very close to his father. He was acting as Johann Forster's assistant. He was a bit of an artist as well, I think, because he was doing drawings for his dad. And I think he's sharply intelligent and absorbs everything that he sees and writes about it.
Anne Sammond, she's the author of The Trial of the Cannibal Dog, Captain Cook in the South Seas.
A voyage round the world. Run from the Cape to the Antarctic Circle. First season spent in high southern latitudes.
The Resolution sailed from Plymouth to Madeira and then on to Cape Town, where she took on supplies for the long voyage ahead. In November 1772, she left Cape Town and plunged southwards.
We sailed from Table Bay about 4 in the afternoon on the 22nd of November. The wind blew in hard squalls, which continued all night and gave us once more a rough reception on the boisterous element.
Moderate gales and cloudy weather with a large swell from southward. In the PM, served to each man a fear not jacket and a pair of trousers, which were allowed by the Admiralty.
As we were now entering an unexampled navigation, not knowing when we might meet with a new place of refreshment, the captain gave the strictest orders to prevent the waste of fresh water. The captain himself washed with salt water, and all our company were obliged to conform to this necessary restriction.
So, Mr. Forster, we have scorched and steamed you all through the tropics until you are quite cooked. Are you ready now to be packed in ice?
I'm not sure, sir. But the wind can't be any colder than it was in the village where I grew up. It blew straight out of Russia.
I fear you may be in for a surprise, Mr. Forster.
Sailing south-south-east, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Gilbert. Now at last we shall see for once and all whether our fabled southern continent exists, or whether it is to be found only in the minds of learned gentlemen in their studies in Kent and Hampshire.
You don't think we shall find it?
That's not for me to say. I am merely following His Majesty's instructions as conveyed to me by Lord Sandwich.
Now, Captain Cook hadn't set out to become an Antarctic explorer. His instructions from the Admiralty were to search for the great southern continent, Terra Australis Incognita.
The search for Terra Australis was really like the space race, you know. It's the equivalent of the space race last century, where great European powers competed to find an unknown domain, you know, a place which might have unknown forms of life. They wanted to get there first for reasons of prestige, but also potentially economic reasons. But it was an important part of geopolitical strategy at that time in Europe.
Interest in the southern land was not purely geographic. It wasn't a question of academic interest. People thought that maybe there might be another whole landmass like China, where new sorts of products, they were thinking of the super profits gained from spices, possibly this unknown continent might have all sorts of new plants and products that would enable new markets, a whole new kind of trade.
On the 29th, the wind, which had for 3 or 4 days past blown a very strong gale, now increased so much that we ran during the last 24 hours almost under the bare foresail. The sea at the same time ran very high and frequently broke over the sloop.
Fresh gales with a great sea from the westward. In the night, frost, and in the AM, showers of snow and sleet.
And the howl of the storm in the rigging, the roar of the waves, added to the violent agitation of the vessel. The air was likewise unpleasantly sharp and cold about this time, our latitude being now about 42 degrees south, and frequent rains contributed to make the service of the seamen hard and comfortless.
So that there's really a sense of almost mounting horror to find that the temperature is dropping very rapidly. They are, after all, voyaging in the southern summer. They might reasonably have expected that it would be relatively mild, especially because they're in latitudes similar to those of northern England at home, where at that time of year, in the equivalent season, it's going to be fairly mild. But, of course, what they didn't know was that because the southern hemisphere has so much more ocean than the northern, the climate generally is fundamentally much colder.
Towards night, it grew colder again. This great cold preceded the sight of ice floating in the sea, which we fell in with on the next morning.
Stood to the south-southeast with wind at southwest from noon till 8 p.m., in which time 20 islands of ice presented themselves to our view. We now sounded, but found no ground with 150 fathoms of line. At 6:30, we were stopped by an immense field of ice, to which we could see no end. We now bore away south-southeast, southeast, and southeast by south as the ice trended, keeping close by the edge of it, where we saw many penguins and whales and many of the ice birds, small grey birds and pintados.
Sometimes we tacked our way painstakingly between immense fields of flat ice. Then we would find our way out again into clear water and breathe easier until the fog fell and lifted to show a great ice island bearing down on us.
Stood to the south till 8 p.m., at which time we were in the latitude of 61 degrees 52 minutes. The ice islands were now so numerous that we had passed upwards of 60 or 70 since noon, many of them a mile or a mile and a half in circuit, increasing both in number and magnitude as we advanced to the south. Under these circumstances, and surrounded on every side with huge pieces of ice, equally as dangerous as so many rocks, it was natural for us to wish for daylight, which when it came was so far from lessening the danger that it served to increase our apprehensions thereof by exhibiting to our view those mountains of ice which in the night would have been passed unseen.
Certainly they had a perception that these icebergs were truly vast. They were on a scale like nothing anywhere else in the world. And they were also horrified by them because of the risk they posed to the ship.
A thick fog enveloped the ship and everything beyond, so thick that the topsails were entirely lost to view, and the masts and yards were no more than shadows. The red smudges of the sailors' caps were all the colour in the world. At 10 o'clock in the evening, there was still no sign of darkness setting in, but neither could the sky be said to be light. Midsummer night was less than a fortnight away, yet we moved in a dim grey wraith world.
At 6 o'clock, the weather became hazy, and soon after, a thick fog. The wind, however, veered more and more to the northeast, which enabled us to clear the field of ice, though at the same time it carried us among the islands, which we had enough to do to keep clear of. Of two evils, I thought this the least. Dangerous as it is sailing amongst the floating rocks in a thick fog and unknown sea, yet it is preferable to being entangled with field ice under the same circumstances.
Apart from seabirds and seals and penguins and the odd narwhal, we were the only creatures alive in the ice world. So to keep ourselves company, we peopled it with white tigers and horses, dogs, elephants, and other even more improbable animals we claimed to make out of the fantastic twisted shapes of the ice.
Great as these dangers are, the apprehensions they cause are never of long duration, and are in some measure compensated by the very curious and romantic views many of these islands exhibit, and which are greatly heightened by the foaming and dashing of the waves against them and into the several holes and caverns which are formed in most of them. In short, the whole exhibits a view which can only be described by the pencil of an able painter, and at once fills the mind with admiration and horror. The first is occasioned by the beautifulness of the picture, and the latter by the danger attending it. For was a ship to fall aboard one of these large pieces of ice, she would be dashed to pieces in a moment.
There was indeed an able painter, in Cook's words, on board the Resolution. His name was William Hodges, and he drew and painted a number of striking scenes from the Antarctic voyage. Those pictures are now held in the Mitchell Library in New South Wales, and the curator of pictures there is Louise Annemat.
Hodges was a professionally trained artist. He was only 28 at the time of the voyage, and he was part of the contingent that replaced Sir Joseph Banks's party. Artists had become very, very important on voyages of exploration and discovery as the only way that they had, prior to photography, of documenting where they'd been and what they'd seen. It was very, very important as their only visual record, and it complemented the written record. All naval officers were required to keep journals, very detailed journals, which were then sealed up and handed over to the Admiralty. So the work that the artists did complemented the journals to give them a fuller picture.
On the 9th in the morning, we saw a large island of ice surrounded with many small broken pieces. And the weather being moderate, we brought to, hoisted out the boats, and sent them to take up as much of the small ice as they could.
The pieces we took up and which had brought from the main island were very hard and solid, and some of them too large to be handled, so that we were obliged to break them with our ice axes before they could be taken into the boats. We took up as much as yielded about 15 tonnes of fresh water.
That's right, so this is the Resolution and Adventure, 4th of January 1773, taking in ice from water. William Hodges.
It actually shows crew members, they've climbed over the edge of the ship and they're clambering over an iceberg. And in this image, the figures of the crew are tiny, tiny little characters, so you get a sense of the enormity of the icebergs compared to the ship. But they did actually do this. They did climb down, chop off great bits of icebergs and load them back onto the ship.
We piled up the lumps on the quarterdeck, packed them into casks, and after dinner melted them in the coppers and obtained about 30 days' water.
The melting of the ice is a little tedious and takes up some time. Otherwise, this is the most expeditious way of watering I ever met with.
You're listening to Hindsight on ABC Radio National. I'm Tom Morton, and we're voyaging in the Antarctic with Captain Cook and the young writer and naturalist Georg Forster. Not only were Cook and Forster seeing sights that no one had ever seen before, they were also hearing sounds that no human ear had ever heard before. Sounds like these, captured by sound recordist Ron Minogue for the ABC and by Douglas Quinn, Peter Fullagar and Edric Slater.
Friday, 25th of December. At noon, seeing that the people were inclinable to celebrate Christmas Day in their own way,
I brought the sloops under a very snug sail, lest I should be surprised with a gale of wind with a drunken crew. This action was, however, unnecessary, for the wind continued to blow in a gentle gale.
Adam, catch thee by the fir below. Adam, catch thee by the fir below. And that's the oldest catch I know.
Another glass of rum, Captain.
No, thank you, Mr. Vancouver. Someone on this ship must be sober, and I fear it must be me.
Mr. Forster's still sober.
Drink, little cousin. Drink to the king whose name you share.
I don't drink usually, but since it is Christmas Day, I will drink to peace and brotherhood between men.
I'd sooner the sisterhood.
You'll have to wait until we reach Tahiti for that.
Here's to science, which has brought men of diverse nations together in one quest, and which may soon bring together men and women of many nations.
Come down in the gun room where the people are now, and you'll hear a jig or two and see some sport.
What sort of sport does he mean?
I believe they are holding a boxing match. I dare say there will be a broken nose or two in the morning, but it helps them to let off steam.
Men swayed back and forth, leaning on one another. Some clapped or stamped their feet more or less in time to the music. Others strained to catch a glimpse of something that was happening in the centre of the room, where the cheering was loudest. I squeezed my way forwards, an easy thing since I was more sober than anyone around us. In the centre of the room, a space had been cleared, no more than 3 paces across, and fresh sawdust spread on the floorboards. Stripped to the waist, sweat gleaming on shoulders and necks and chests, 2 sailors faced each other, fists raised, quivering. Suddenly one danced forward and jabbed with his left fist at the other's face. His antagonist fended off the blow with his forearm, but could not check the other fist, which came up powerfully from the right, catching him underneath the nose. There was a sickening crunch, and he fell to his knees. Blood streamed down his forearm and dripped onto the sawdust. The young man tried to rise, but could not. More cheers went up. Money changed hands. The victor drained a mug of grog, while the vanquished was helped to his feet and given the same. I staggered out into the clear, bitter night and found my way to my cabin. I drew the blanket over me and was asleep at once.
Monday, 4th of January. We were now about 1.5 degrees or 2 degrees of longitude to the west of the meridian of Cape Circumcision.
Captain is in a good mood. He's seldom so talkative.
Indeed. Perhaps you can clear something up for me, Mr. Clark.
Perhaps.
Cape Circumcision. How did it get its name?
You've heard of Bouvet.
The French explorer who sailed from Brazil down into the Southern Ocean?
The very same. The story is that Bouvet sighted it on the 1st of January, the Feast of the Circumcision, in the midst of a thick fog. By all accounts, it's a godforsaken spot, nothing but bare rock and ice. But the sailors say it's called that because the cold will freeze the end off your cock.
The weather was so clear that land, even of a moderate height, might have been seen 15 leagues, so that there could be no land betwixt us and the latitude of 48 degrees. In short, I am of the opinion that what Monsieur Bouvet took for land and named Cape Circumcision was nothing but mountains of ice surrounded by field ice.
The sight of seals and penguins once more revived the hopes of some of our fellow voyagers, who bid us look out for land, which by their account could not be far off. Our course, however, soon disappointed their expectations, and only served to invalidate their testimonies of the proximity of land.
while Georg Forster comments on the fact that it is very unlikely that they find a great landmass, he also always comments about the sailors who, with every kind of little incident, expect land to appear. So all the birds are kind of watched intently for any signs of land. It was, of course, believed that driftwood or birds would indicate the proximity of land. So even though they travelled for such a long time in the south and they did not encounter land, nevertheless, they always read these signs in regards to land.
That's Christiane Weller. She's a lecturer in German studies at Monash University and an expert on Georg Forster. The sounds you're hearing now are Weddell seals, recorded in Antarctica by Douglas Quinn. The man who gave them their name, a later Antarctic explorer called James Weddell, compared the cries of these seals to the voices of mermaids. Well, he must have been desperate. But then, who wouldn't be after a long sojourn in the ice world? And after 3 months in the Antarctic, Cook's crew were feeling pretty desperate themselves.
We had now been long at sea, without receiving any refreshment. The weather daily became more sharp and uncomfortable. Our rigging was constantly encrusted with ice, which cut the hands of those who were obliged to touch it. The sharp saline element alternately numbed and scarified the sailors' limbs.
Well, Cook himself says little in his journal about the effect that these conditions are having on the crew. But Georg Forster's father, Reinhold, becomes increasingly obsessed by the state of his cabin and his health. He writes in his journal of fever, swelling in the neck, rheumatism, and poor appetite. And he's convinced that his cabin is the coldest and wettest in the ship.
Winds east southeast, east northeast, course north by east, distance sailed 96 miles.
It's an outrage, and here's the proof.
What is it this time, Dr. Forster?
It is barely warmer now in my cabin than on the deck, where a howling gale is blowing. And this morning, when I rose to dress, it was colder inside than out.
The latter does not surprise me, for we had little sunshine in the hours immediately after dawn. As to the former, I fear there is little I can do. We cannot light a fire in your cabin.
I am ill. My appetite is quite destroyed. I cannot be exposed to further hardship in my condition.
If you wish, I'll have a hammock slung for you below, with the people. It is undoubtedly warmer there, owing to the quantity of bodies.
It's an outrage. The king shall hear of this.
While the father was a very sort of difficult person, and some of the officers, or one of the officers, Elliot, describes him as litigious and quarrelsome, but some kind of clever fellow, Georg is, I think, sort of much more friendly with the officers on board. He's definitely, he has quite a good relationship with Cook. So I think Georg tries to soften the sort of interaction between the father and the officers on board, and at times also between the father and Cook. That becomes quite a complicated and problematic relationship during the voyage.
By March 1773, the short Antarctic summer is over. Temperatures are falling and conditions on the ship are getting worse.
Notwithstanding our excellent preservatives, especially the sauerkraut, several of our people had now strong symptoms of sea scurvy, such as bad gums, difficult breathing, livid blotches, eruptions, contracted limbs, and greenish, greasy filaments in the urine.
Again, Cook makes no mention in his journal of the outbreak of scurvy on the ship. But in mid-March, he finally gives the order to head north for New Zealand, to the great relief of the Forsters and everybody else on board. Over the next 7 months, the Resolution makes a broad sweep across the South Pacific, visiting Tahiti, Tonga, and the Society Islands. The Pacific is an exhilarating experience for the young Georg Forster. His book teems with vivid and often sensual descriptions of the lives and customs of the Pacific peoples and of their encounters with Europeans. In the Society Islands, one of the islanders joins the Resolution as a passenger. He's Hiti Hiti.
Well, Hiti Hiti's a fascinating young guy. He was quite a young Arioi. Now, the Arioi were a kind of cult, I suppose you could say, or a society, a secret society almost, dedicated to the war god Oro in the Society Islands. And they were voyagers, they were lovers, they were artists, musicians and warriors. And Hiti Hiti was quite a high-born young man. He was, it seems, a nephew of Puni, who was the conqueror of the Society Islands at that time. And so he came on board as an extended version of an Arioi voyage, just as Joseph Banks in the first voyage had gone off on a grand tour that was going to excel everybody else's. Hiti Hiti was on the Arioi voyage of all time.
Well, there can be little doubt that everybody on the Resolution, apart from Captain Cook, would gladly have stayed in the Pacific rather than making a second foray into the Antarctic. But Cook was absolutely determined to make certain that there could be no Terra Australis Incognita still lurking somewhere in the Southern Ocean. So he decides to return to New Zealand, replenish supplies, and give the ship a thorough overhaul before heading south. And it's in New Zealand that an incident occurs which deeply shocks both Cook and Galen Forster.
Tuesday, 23rd November, 1773. Calm or light airs from the northward, so that we could not get to sea as I intended. Some of the officers went on shore to amuse themselves among the natives, where they saw the head and bowels of a youth who had lately been killed. The heart was stuck upon a forked stick and fixed to the head of their largest canoe.
They were hardly recovered from their first surprise when the natives showed them several limbs of the body and expressed by words and gestures that they had eaten the rest. The head, without the lower jawbone, was one of the parts which remained, and from which it plainly appeared that the deceased was a youth about 15 or 16 years old. The skull was fractured near one of the temples, as it seemed by the stroke of a patu-patu. This gave our officers an opportunity of inquiring how they came in possession of the body. The natives answered that they had fought with their enemies and had killed several of them, without being able to bring away any of the dead besides this youth.
Well, what they see is a party of warriors who've come back home from a raid. They've captured somebody and sacrificed them, and they'd been off raiding for greenstone, I'm absolutely certain, so that they could trade it to the Europeans. They'd learnt by then the value of iron, for example, and they were desperately eager to get it. So I think they'd just gone raiding across the hills, had attacked people from another kin group who were their enemies, and had captured this war captive and killed him.
Mr. Pickersgill proposed to purchase the head in order to preserve it till his return to England, where it might serve as a memorial of this voyage. He offered a nail and immediately obtained the head for this price, after which he returned on board with his company and placed it on the taffrail. We were all occupied in examining it when some New Zealanders came on board from the watering place. At sight of the head, they expressed an ardent desire of possessing it, signifying by the most intelligible gestures that it was delicious to the taste. Mr. Pickersgill refused to part with it, but agreed to cut off a small piece from the cheek, with which they seemed to be well satisfied.
Lieutenant Pickersgill is one of the more colourful characters on the Resolution. He's known as a bit of a drinker, a clown, but in his own way, he's also a man of science.
And Pickersgill, being Pickersgill, he was a bit of a practical joker. He conducted this mock barbecue because there'd been all the scepticism. Of course, they'd seen some evidence of cannibalism in Queen Charlotte Sound during the Endeavour visit to Queen Charlotte Sound during the first voyage. But they hadn't actually seen Māori eating human flesh. And so when they went back and reported it in Britain and in Europe, there was a lot of scepticism. Wow. And so they decided, Pickersgill decided, to prove that, in fact, Māori did eat people.
He cut off the part he had promised and offered it to them, but they would not eat it raw and made signs to have it dressed. Therefore, in presence of all the ship's company, it was broiled over the fire, after which they devoured it before our eyes with the greatest avidity.
So it was this burlesque, rough humour, mock scientific experiment, mock barbecue on the deck of the Resolution in the absence of Cook and Hetty Hetty. Cook and Hetty Hetty came on board, and Cook wanted to see for himself. He was he was by then somebody that had quite a lot to do with the Royal Society. He knew about experimental procedure. He knew about the importance of eyewitness accounts. And so he asked that the demonstration be repeated.
The sight of the head and the relation of the circumstances just mentioned struck me with horror and filled my mind with indignation against these cannibals. But when I considered that any resentment I could show would avail but little, and being desirous of being an eyewitness to a fact which many people had their doubts about, I concealed my indignation and ordered a piece of the flesh to be broiled and brought on the quarterdeck, where one of these cannibals ate it with a seeming good relish before the whole ship's company.
And when it was repeated, Hetty Hetty was just aghast, because there was no cannibalism in the Society Islands. It was human sacrifice. You took human jawbones and put them on marae, but you didn't eat human flesh. It was something, that was something the gods were thought to do, to consume the sacrifice, but not people.
But the sensibility of Hetty Hetty shone out with superior lustre among us. He turned his eyes from the unnatural object and retired into the cabin to give vent to the emotions of his heart. There we found him, bathed in tears. His looks were a mixture of compassion and grief, and as soon as he saw us, he expressed his concern for the unhappy parents of the victim. This turn which his reflections had taken gave us infinite pleasure. It spoke of a humane heart, filled with the warmest sentiments of social affection, and habituated to sympathise with its fellow creatures.
So, what does this particular incident mean for the Maori, the people who've actually carried out this raid and then brought back this corpse? What does it mean in the context of their culture?
Well, cannibalism in Maori, kai tangata, it's eating the ho, the breath of life, the wind of life in the soul of that person, the kind of spirit of that person. And it's a way of destroying their link with their ancestors. It's a way of destroying their mana, their sacred, their ancestral power. And if you do that to a chief, for example, if you manage to cook and eat, especially their head, because that was the most sacred part of the body, and then eat it, that was the worst insult that you could possibly perform on any kin group, was to do that to the head of the chief. And you were just annulling and destroying the sacred prestige, power, mana of those people, not just the chief, but all of his descendants, all of his kin group as well. And so it's very likely that when the people on board the Resolution participated in that mock barbecue, that they were linking themselves to the kin group that had gone off and performed the raid. And they would have become enemies to the people whose young man this was.
Dame Anne Salmond. She's Distinguished Professor at the University of Auckland and also the author of numerous books on Maori culture and history. Now, Georg Forster's response to these acts of cannibalism shows him developing some of the ideas which will later make him a leading figure in the Radical Enlightenment. Above all, it's his belief in the fundamental equality of all human beings which shines through here.
But though we are too much polished to be cannibals, we do not find it unnaturally and savagely cruel to take the field and to cut one another's throats by thousands without a single motive besides the ambition of a prince or the caprice of his mistress. Is it not from prejudice that we are disgusted with the idea of eating a dead man when we feel no remorse in depriving him of life? A New Zealander who kills and eats his enemy is a very different being from a European who, for his amusement, tears an infant from the mother's breast in cool blood and throws it on the earth to feed his hounds.
In late November 1773, the Resolution left New Zealand and made for the Antarctic for a second time.
The second course towards the high southern latitudes.
And the atmosphere on the ship is more sombre this time around.
About 7 in the evening on that day, we were in the latitude of 51 degrees 33 minutes south and longitude 180 degrees, consequently at the antipodes of London. The remembrance of domestic felicity and of the sweets of society called forth a sigh from every heart which felt the tender ties of filial or parental affection. We are the first Europeans, and I believe I may add the first human beings who have reached this point, where it is probable none will come after us.
You've slept long, Mr. Foster. It's afternoon already.
Have you seen my father anywhere? He's not in his cabin or anywhere else that I can see.
Your pa's away in a boat with Mr. Gilbert and Mr. Wales.
In a boat? In this fog?
It were clear when they took the boat. The fog's only come down this last half hour.
If you're wondering where your father is, the truth is we don't know. He and Gilbert and Wales set off in the jolly boat at least an hour ago to make observations, I am told, though what they were intending to observe in this godforsaken spot and why Gilbert went with him, I cannot think.
Are they in any danger?
Not if they keep their heads. The sails are still set snug as they were yesterday, so we're hardly moving. Gilbert is no fool. He will ship oars and wait until the fog lifts.
Father! Can you hear me?
I doubt if he will hear you. The fog swallows up all sound.
You must send out another boat. I'll go with it.
If you think I'll risk more men, let alone a boat, you're a bigger fool than your father, and a bigger fool than I took you for.
Then I'll go alone. I beg you, give me a boat.
You can't even row.
Then I demand to see the captain.
Hold up, or I'll have you in irons, gentleman or no. The captain is sleeping. I will not disturb his rest.
Do what you like with me, but do you think he will thank you for leaving three men to...
Stand easy, Mr. Foster. There's more spunk in you than I'd guessed. I could almost take you for an Englishman.
Mr. Clark, what the devil is going on? I thought I heard a shot, and I am not given to dreaming.
You did indeed, sir. We are signalling to Mr. Gilbert.
Signalling? What do you mean, man? Has he sprouted wings during the night and taken to the air?
Mr. Gilbert has taken Mr. Wales and Dr. Foster out in the jolly boat to take some measurements.
Measurements? They'll be taking the measurements of the brig if there's any more foolishness of this sort.
Boat to starboard!
Where? I can't see anything.
Yes, there. Look there.
There you are, lad. Your father safe and sound. Though I fancy he has icicles on his nose.
Father, how could you go off without me?
I tried to rouse you, but you were in a stupor.
I think, Dr. Forster, that you and Mr. Wales and Mr. Gilbert had better go straight to your quarters and drive the cold out of your bones. You're all lucky to be alive.
There was no danger. We were perfectly safe.
For God's sake, Father, do as the captain says.
Friday, 24th of December, 1773. Thermometer, noon, 32 degrees. Our ropes were like wires, sails like board or plates of metal, and the shivers froze fast in the blocks so that it required our utmost effort to get a topsail down and up.
Our situation at present was indeed very dismal, even to those who preserved the blessing of health. To the sick, whose crippled limbs were tortured with excessive pain, it was insupportable. The ocean about us had a furious aspect and seemed incensed at the presumption of a few intruding mortals.
By now, conditions on the Resolution can only be described as desperate. Scurvy is rife, but still Captain Cook presses on.
A gloomy, melancholy air lowered on the brows of our shipmates, and a dreadful silence reigned amongst us. Salt meat, our constant diet, was become loathsome to all, and even to those who had been bred to a nautical life from their tender years, the hour of dinner was hateful to us, for the well-known smell of the victuals had no sooner reached our nose than we found it impossible to partake of them with a hearty appetite.
December the 27th. A very faint breeze is just springing up. The islands of ice surrounding the ship look like the wrecks of a destroyed world.
A little after 4 a.m., we perceived the clouds to the south near the horizon to be of an unusual snow-white brightness, which announced our approach to field ice. The outer or northern edge of this immense ice field was composed of loose or broken ice, so close packed together that nothing could enter it. About a mile in began the firm ice, in one compact solid body, and seemed to increase in height as you traced it to the south. In this field, we counted 97 ice hills or mountains, many of them vastly large.
This moment when Cook confronts the impenetrable field of ice before him is the great triumph of his career. He's pushed his crew to the limits of their endurance, brought them to the very edge of the knowable world.
And this moment, I think, is revealing in that it betrays the extent of his ambition and his determination to succeed in it. He doesn't really care that they don't find a southern continent. What he cares about is having proven that there was not one in the most rigorous and complete way possible.
But as it was impossible to proceed farther, we put the ship about, well satisfied with our perilous expedition, and almost persuaded that no navigator will care to come after, and much less attempt to pass beyond us.
Georg Forster's voyage around the world is an enduring tribute to the greatest navigator of his age. Forster himself would go on to achieve a different kind of fame as a revolutionary and founder of the first short-lived republic on German soil. But Forster also left an important legacy to science.
This was really a foundational moment in the interplay between science, travel, and aesthetics. Forster's delight, that interest in the novelty and the curiosity of the Antarctic environment is indissociable from the business of scientific curiosity. And Forster's attitude in this case becomes tremendously influential subsequently. One of the greatest natural historians of the early 19th century, Alexander von Humboldt, cites Forster's voyage as one of his inspirations, as one of the texts that compels him to pursue a career in natural history. So that even though George Forster is not at all a household name, he is really a pivotal figure in the history of science and exploration.
You've been listening to Into the Ice World, which was shortlisted for this year's New South Wales Premier's History Award. In the program, you heard Sam Smith as Georg Forster, Patrick Dixon as Captain Cook, Gerhard Fischer as Johann Reinhold Forster, and Cameron Stewart as Charlie Clark. The sailors were played by Mark Don, Stephen Tilley, John Cochrane, Nick Franklin, and Danny Maritos. Today's Hindsight was written and produced by Tom Morton, with Andrew McLennan. Technical production was by Judy Rapley, and you can find more information about both Forster and Cook on the Hindsight website. I'm Claudia Taranto, and I hope you can join me next Sunday afternoon here on Radio National Summer.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.